We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast is brought to you by Aspers Casino Newcastle, home of the Mag's £4 pint. Available on all draft beers for all NUFC home and televised games, 12 p.m. to 12 a.m. Over 18s only. Visit begambleaware.org, be drinkaware. For details and T's and C's, visit aspersnewcastle.co.uk.
It's your True Faith Newcastle United podcast, and it's a PSL special. It's what you're all calling out for. We are going to talk about profit and sustainability rules, but we're going to do it with Chris Woff of The Athletic. So it'll be really interesting and informed, no doubt. No pressure, Chris, of course. I'm Charlotte. I'm also joined by John Lane to chat through proposed changes to PSR rules. What's likely, what's not likely, and how will it impact Newcastle United? And then let's apply that to the summer and what we think might happen or might not happen. Quick note from me that we are on Patreon. It's between £3 and £8 a month for tons of extra content. If you just want this kind of podcast ad-free, including me talking about Patreon, it is the £3 tier. If you want 7 more podcasts a week about Newcastle United, it's the £8 tier. So please do come and join us there. There's loads of great content and we would love to have you. Let's get into it then, Chris. I can tell that you are very excited about talking about PSR because...
Yeah, well, just like you started following football for PSR, the reason I got into sports journalism is because I wanted to cover PSR, so I just feel privileged to be on. Thank you.
I know it was a toss-up for you at university between accountancy and journalism, so it's a real boon that you can combine those two interests.
Oh, exactly, yeah. Exactly.
So... Let's talk about it. Everton, we're doing this podcast in the wake of Everton just being docked a couple of more points. Obviously 10 reduced to 6 earlier on in the season, then a couple more, and then possibly more to come even from that. And of course, this is because they breached PSR, profit and sustainability rules, which sort of falls under the umbrella of FFP and it has replaced FFP in our lexicon. But there's a lot of talk about what might change and that Premier League clubs are not particularly happy with the way that it's being applied, with the way that it's working, and the fact that it is making us potentially a less attractive option to top talent, etc. So let's talk through kind of what the proposed changes might be, which may even happen in June. Am I right?
Well, I think they could be voted through in June. I think the likelihood is that wouldn't come in for next season. I think it would probably be for the following season or maybe the season right after that. But the likelihood is that the current regulations will still be in place going into 2024, 25s it'll be. But basically, I mean, the current rules are that in theory, over the course of a 3-year rolling period, if you have an injection of cash covered by the ownership, you can lose up to £105 million. Now, that is not just to get even more complicated, that doesn't just replicate, for example, in the most recent accounts Newcastle had, the loss there, the full amount of that loss does not necessarily go towards that because you get exemptions for things like the academy, for the women's team, for infrastructure spending, for various different other elements. But largely, if you spend more than you actually bring in, then you could be in breach of these regulations over a certain period of time. A lot of clubs have either been in breach, as we've seen, Everton, Nottingham Forest, allegedly Manchester City could be, allegedly Chelsea could be at some stage, and various other clubs. are very, very close or have been very, very close. And there is talk that this summer, before June the 30th, that that's almost its own transfer deadline day for clubs to try, because that's when the accounting year ends. So that's when clubs will try and get some business done to make sure they comply. But then there's going to be the second transfer deadline day of the summer, which is the usual one. And that's a bizarre scramble that there may be, but that's the position everyone is in. Because really, we've seen over the course of the last 6 months that actually PSR does have teeth and the Premier League will actually apply and come down hard on it. Whereas, as I was featured on a previous podcast here, I remember Alex coming back at me when I said that I think Newcastle and a lot of other clubs were surprised when Everton were initially docked points in November. But I think there was surprise by how severe that was, even though subsequently that has been reduced to a certain degree. So sorry to ramble on, but the proposed changes are to fall in line with the rules that have come in for UEFA, which at UEFA level, it's called the Financial Sustainability Regulations. And essentially the way that that works, rather than the way that the PSR works at the moment, is that it's basically a ratio of your revenue, which would then cover transfer fees, player wages and the like that you can spend on. So eventually Europe on a European level, over a sort of tapered level, it would be 70% of your revenue you're allowed to spend annually on a combined transfer fees, player wages and the likes. Whereas the Premier League, it seems, are looking at a sort of 85% revenue cap. But you have to remember that within that, those clubs who actually qualify for European competition will have to actually meet the 70% ratio, because there will also be European rules, which Newcastle have had to be this season, but they've been 90%, I think, this season. So Newcastle are right on that front. Sorry to ramble on, and I realise that was very boring and convoluted, but this is quite convoluted. So, yeah.
No, not boring at all. John, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting one, because there's been also reports recently, hasn't there, Chris, that they're looking at, obviously the luxury tax is the one that's kind of popped out at everyone. And I spoke to Kieran Maguire a couple of weeks ago on Northeast Divide podcast, and what I'd said to him was kind of, well, what would you put in place to keep it competitive? Because I think the issue with PSR at the minute is it's talking about being, you know, about keeping clubs sustainable, but really it's about kind of protecting an elite few clubs who already have that revenue. And he suggested a luxury tax. But is there not going to be an issue there? Because then it has to comply with UEFA if you qualify for Europe as well. Like, I can't see how the two can kind of marry in the middle.
Yeah, that's part of the issue, which I think, hasn't necessarily been considered as much, that in theory you could have that luxury tax and then Newcastle could spend... Well, Newcastle, for example, or another club could spend over their present means, pay what is essentially a fine for doing that, knowing that they will hopefully get some sort of sporting advantage from it. But then if they do qualify for European competition, then they have to comply with the revenue anyway. So really, that wouldn't necessarily work in practice and would probably actually be more applicable for a club lower down the Premier League, who probably you wouldn't suspect would have the funds that necessarily others did, unless they were really desperate to avoid relegation and so may sort of do a splurge in a January window or whatever. The luxury tax is an interesting one, because it's obviously got a lot of coverage over the last couple of weeks, and it is something that is being considered. But my understanding, and this comes from both conversations I've had, but also people high up at the Athletic, who basically cover these things on a day-to-day basis, that this is just very much something that is being proposed by some clubs, probably by those who may actually potentially continue to be in breach of PSR going forward, and that they see that as a potential way out of it and something they would like. And all of these are very much ideas that are being discussed at the moment. What was interesting from the last Premier League meeting was when they've confirmed that they are looking to change the sort of PSR going forward, is that there is no confirmation as to exactly what that's going to be, because the clubs are split. There are different camps who want different things. And you can imagine it doesn't take a genius to work out who may be in those different camps. I mean, we already know that Manchester City are potentially threatening legal action over some of the other rules that the Premier League have brought in to do with related party transactions. But other clubs who may potentially be in breach or fear being breached will probably be keener for the rules to be relaxed or changed than those who see themselves as being compliant. So all of this is very much up in the air. There's a lot of self-interest there. And we have to remember that although a lot of clubs are shackled by these PSR rules now, at the end of the day, the Premier League is actually a 20 club member organization and they decide on the rules. Now, obviously, three of those members change on an annual basis and also ownership changes. For example, when these rules came in, it was obviously under Mike Ashley rather than the present ownership. But there was at least some agreement when these rules first came in. And to change that is going to, I don't think we're at the stage yet where there is actually a consensus as to what's going to happen going forward.
I think the changes, that there really is a massive amount of possibilities with regards to the changes and still keeping it competitive, because obviously the Premier League, I think you underplay how much self-interest there is here. Like, sure, it's a 20 member organization, but it's very much an every man for himself organization. You want to stay in that organization every season and you want to get to the top of that organization, and then you're allowed in another organization and you can go and play in that one. And it's all very much, to me, every man for himself kind of thing. And there's all these kind of potential changes coming in. Now, the luxury tax is only one of them. There are other things. There's the UEFA kind of model that there's talks about caps on wages, caps on coaching staff and things like that, or not taking that into consideration where it is at the moment. And I think one of the things that interests me so much is, like, there's a lot of parallels drawn to the US and NBA and things like that, and NFL and caps on wages and caps and things like that. And maybe we could do something like that. And I think it's much easier to apply those kinds of rules in America to those sports, because those sports basically only exist in America. And so you're not hindering a national league so much, because players aren't going to go to the Bundesliga equivalent or Liga equivalent, but in this case they will. So the Premier League has to protect itself and its competitiveness and its attractiveness to both players and sponsors, but also not get out of hand. And I just think, I don't know what you think to this, Chris, but I just think it's almost a Sisyphean task. Like, you can't necessarily do that. It's almost one or the other.
Yeah, I think one of the models you're referring to, which they're considering, is, I think it's referred to as an anchoring model, which is something they do have in some US sports, where basically it would be the whatever the television revenue paid to the bottom placed club on an annual basis, that revenue times by a certain figure. And the suggestion is it might be 4.5, for example, is the maximum that you could spend yourself on salaries, for example. Now, those sorts of things, I think something like that may come in, but I agree with you that the problem then is, how do you eventually, longer term, because the Premier League is so far ahead of other leagues financially, I think it wouldn't be an issue in the short to medium term, but longer term, you potentially do harm your competitive nature there. So, but I think if you want some sort of spending restrictions, and if you want some sort of quote unquote level playing field, and I do very much say that quote unquote because it's never going to be that, then I do see the logic behind this. And I think that the idea that the Premier League is really going to struggle because of a lack of funds or restricting itself, I think is unrealistic, really, in the short term. I just think they're so far ahead of other leagues that, yes, very much long term, it could be an issue. But in the next few years, in some ways, the Premier League, as much of it was interesting. I was chatting to an agent a few months ago, and he referred to the Premier League as like a golden cage. And what he was saying there was, if you had a certain club, if you join the Premier League club and you reach a certain level and have a certain wage packet and basically were bought for a certain fee, there are very few clubs you can actually go to. Even if you become a very, very good player, you could be at a mid-table Premier League club. And unless you go to a Premier League club higher, no clubs, even at the very top level of European football, beyond sort of Real Madrid or PSG, can actually afford you. And so the Premier League is in such a strong position relative to it that I don't think it's really going to damage it in the short to medium term. So I think in some ways to continue the competitiveness that makes the Premier League the sort of global brand that it is, I do think that eventually they're going to have to come up with some model. I don't know what that is, and I don't know which of these proposals will actually be voted through, but I do see the logic behind actually trying to bring some of them rather than the current system, which seems to be broken, really.
Agreed. So on that note, what, like, let's start rowing it back over to Newcastle. What kind of thing do you think is likely, bearing in mind that 14 clubs have to tick the box and say, yes, we agree with this measure, and we think this is the right way. What do you, like, personal opinion, and it's okay if it doesn't happen, and it's okay to be wrong. Something I'm learning in life, it's okay to be wrong. It hasn't happened to me yet, but it, you know, it's okay. What do you think's likely to happen? Like, do you think they're going to do a seismic kind of change, or do you think it's going to be more of a, like small tweaks and see how it plays out? The flip side to that is small tweaks are all well and good, but it's not going to actually come into play until the season after the one after next. So it feels to me like they should just do something big, but maybe I'm just being impulsive.
Yeah, I mean, there is still a chance that they're trying to vote it through for sooner, but the suggestion is that that because it won't be agreed upon, if it even is agreed upon, until June, which would basically be when the new member clubs come in the league, that it would be too short a period to bring it in. But I think that it will almost certainly basically mirror, if not exactly equal, what is at UEFA level. And I think because it doesn't make that much sense to do something which is so divergent from that, because clubs will coming in and out of it. It may be that the revenue that the actual ratio is higher, and that is the suggestion. I think it will be, because 70%, certainly if you're a club like Bournemouth, for example, getting a 70% ratio of all of your spending relative to revenue is very, very difficult, because you obviously have a tiny ground compared to others, and basically all of their money comes from, or a massive proportion of their money comes from TV revenue. So I think it'll be something like that. I think the luxury tax is unlikely for the reasons that we've already said. And I do think that going forward, regardless of whatever the sort of changes are to PSR, I do think that some sort of sporting sanction will remain. A lot of clubs are adamant there has to be, because the problem you have if you only have a luxury tax is that essentially a club could decide to just pay over the odds whatever they want. And if that ends up relegating somebody else because you've decided to pay massively because you can afford to do so, you haven't had that sort of sporting sanction that they were sort of complying within the rules to do. So I do think there needs to be that element, and there seems to be a significant proportion, at least from what I hear, of Premier League clubs who want that as well. So I realise I've dodged the question there to a certain degree, but I generally don't know.
Expertly done. No, and nobody knows. I'm just interested. You know, you're close to it. You speak to people. I wonder if you have a sense of what is likely to happen. And I think it's really worthwhile pointing out that the sporting sanction is most likely to remain some kind of sporting sanction. Otherwise, the sort of nature of the competition is kind of erased in a lot of ways. I think, like, we're owned by Saudi. Yes, the money that our owners have doesn't necessarily equate to the money that we've got to spend, but would they just pay 50 million if it got us out of a pretty unpleasant hole in terms of these finances? Maybe. John, how do you think, and Chris, I'll come to you with this question after. John, how do you think potential changes might impact Newcastle? Do you think it'll give us a bit more freedom? I know you were talking before about the transfer window and the impact it had, not only on Newcastle United, but on the Premier League itself.
Yeah, I think the one obstacle, we've already touched on it, is the Premier League is absolutely rid. It's plagued with self-interest. That's what governs it, and that's what's governed the rules up to now. The PSR rules work really well for some clubs and not well for others. Brighton, as an example, they're massively in favour of PSR, but part of the reason for that is, you know, if they've sold Caicedo and whoever else for the kind of fees that they have, then they're in a massively strong position. So if the rules all of a sudden change and they've got to almost change their model, then that's kind of why they're against it. But I think the impression that the media are given at the minute is that the Premier League itself are really fractured about what they think the right way forward is. And they need to come up with something that's going to work. And I think January was almost like a bit of the clubs showing and saying, right, well, if you're going to give us points deductions, we're not going to do anything because it's not good for the brand. It's, you know, this January transfer window is probably, you know, was almost as interesting as watching paint dry. There was nothing going on, really. I think Spurs did a couple of things early. Apart from that, no one really did anything. And I think it was almost a warning shot by the clubs to say, look, if we don't do something different, it's going to have a massive impact overall on the brand. So the Premier League will be keen to do it, but it's how they do that and they manage to still fall in with UEFA. And just to kind of touch on Chris's point earlier around the ratio and whether that rule would go in, at the minute, what they're proposing is anyone that doesn't qualify for Europe would be able to spend up to 85% as player spend, which is wages, amortization, and agent fees. So you could have a team like Chelsea finish 10th, but then the following season, they could really spend to jump them back up to that top four, top six position. So again, those rules would still really massively benefit the greedy six, whoever you want to call them.
It's the greedy six, but it's also like any article you read about it now talks about Newcastle United, because we're talking about money and we're talking about clubs with money behind them. Newcastle United gets sort of like lumped in. It's now a seven, right, Chris?
Yeah, and there actually are at least some people at Newcastle who've been very much pushing to try and join those sorts of clubs in terms of have that sort of, because they realise the sway that they hold and they want to be part of that conversation in whatever direction the league is heading. They might not hold the same views as the sort of greedy six, for want of a better term, but they also realise that they basically are, to a degree, the power brokers in terms of trying to make things happen. And Newcastle, in that sense, given that it's you need a 14 vote, it's 14 votes. In some ways, Newcastle have become a bit of a kingmaker in that sense, although not obviously with all of the rules that Newcastle have been introduced to sort of restrict Newcastle. And that's interesting in itself, that even within the sort of greedy six, or now the big seven, whatever you want to call it, that there are sort of, as we've talked about self-interest there, there are different, I mean, Man City and Newcastle obviously don't want the related party transaction deals to be as aggressively looked over as they are now, whereas other clubs within that, or Liverpool, for example, and others, are more pushing for that sort of thing. So that's interesting itself. But in terms of how these rules could and would affect Newcastle United, if it is to be something which is similar to UEFA's model, in some ways that benefits Newcastle, because Newcastle realise that if the goal for Newcastle is to be in European competition every single season, so they're going to have to comply with UEFA's rules, and they already had to last season. And that it was interesting because they had it's quite complicated, because at the moment, and I don't know if this is changing, but the UEFA's, at least some of UEFA's financial rules are on an annual basis, so they actually work from like January the 1st to December 31st, whereas obviously the Premier League's financials basically work from July the 1st to June the 30th. So they had to have very complicated sort of structures of working out which one that you stay within and without. And I mean, for accountants, that isn't complicated. But for us trying to understand this, that adds just another layer of complexity to it. Yes, there's layer people like us. But the longer term, I mean, in the short term, in theory, the idea is certainly at a Premier League level, Newcastle would still, to a degree, be entrenched in the position that they're in relative to the clubs with huge revenue, because it's still the more revenue you have, still the greater amount of money you can spend. But longer term, if Newcastle try and replicate the Man City model or another model, and really try and increase their commercial revenues and other revenues as they have been doing it, but they still need to do to a large degree, if they can get there eventually in the medium to long term, Newcastle should be in a fairly strong position from that. It's just they have to make sure that they maximise that. So in the short to medium term, whatever the rules are, I don't think there's going to be a quick fix where suddenly Newcastle are going to be able to access the theoried wealth of their majority owners, because that's just not going to be they're not going to be the rules that are going to be brought in. But this outline of what's being suggested, or what looks most likely, I think longer term, Newcastle can get into a decent position whereby they can try and really challenge that established elite and make sure they become part of it.
Potentially promising then. I think we'll leave it there for part one of the show. Thank you so much, Chris, for your insight. And John, we'll be back after these messages. If you hate messages, join us on Patreon. It's only £3 per month for this podcast ad-free, and also all of our other free podcasts ad-free. We will be back in a moment.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Part two of the show, and I think we need to kind of hone back in on Newcastle United and talk about kind of what these rules mean for us, but for us in the immediate term, so for us in the summer. So there is a lot of media talk today. Joel Linton looks like he's incredibly close to signing a deal. If he hasn't already, they haven't announced it at time of recording. And the understanding I had certainly was that those contract chats were getting difficult because of the amount of money that he wanted. So my assumption is that he's getting quite a substantial amount of money per week if he has indeed signed a new contract. We've already touched on in part one that any changes that get voted through in June by the new members of the Premier League will not necessarily come into force immediately, and they almost certainly won't come into force by the end of the transfer window on the 31st of August. So, Chris, I'm kind of interested in what your take on how we'll approach a transfer window will be in light of these things that we all have to consider now, all these spreadsheets that we have to think about. Is Bruno going to go? Is like how are we going to approach this? A lot. There's loads to talk about. I'll open up the questioning there.
Well, Newcastle are very much approaching this for now as the rules are the same, because the assumption is that they are going to be. So they are looking at it in that, and then if they have to change accordingly, then they will do so. But obviously, Newcastle could not find a way to actually make it work in January where they could actually spend money. The manager clearly wanted players, ideally a midfielder. They looked at trying to offload players, most notably Miguel Almiron, who was offered around, and they looked at trying to get him away to Saudi Arabia if they could, and eventually that deal didn't happen. But it was clear Newcastle had to sell in order to buy. They rejected bids for Kieran Trippier because they didn't want to lose him, and they made the call that they'd rather keep Kieran Trippier than bring in a midfielder. That was the priority at that stage. Now, going into the summer, the PSR situation eases to a degree because fresh revenue comes in on the books for Newcastle, one of which will be the sort of Adidas deal, which comes in from next year in a financial capacity there. You'll also have, obviously, the Champions League revenue from this year. And so over the three-year rolling period, again, it's complicated as to which year each of these come in. But equally, they're going to have, and they are going to announce further commercial deals. And that will help in terms of what Newcastle can actually spend. At the same time, they are still I wouldn't use the term difficult PSR situation, but they have it very much in mind that they may have to sell before June the 30th. There may be someone that they look to offload before then, although at the same time, it's also seen as an opportunity, that pre-June 30th window, because clubs are desperate to sell. And can you actually pick up a bit of a bargain if you can offload someone yourself? So Newcastle are very actively looking at that and hoping that maybe they can actually bring someone in before that window themselves, if they can sort out their own PSR situation. When it comes to selling players, the likelihood is they are going to still have to sell someone. Whether that has to be one of the key players, for which I would have included, as of 3 months ago, Sven Botman, but obviously he's injured, he isn't going to be going anywhere. So the two you'd mainly be looking at now would be Alexander Isak and also Bruno Guimaraes. You would have brought Joe Linton into that bracket if he doesn't sign this new contract, but let's go on the assumption that he is going to, because talks are certainly progressing in that direction, even though he hasn't quite signed just yet. So Isak, Newcastle have absolutely no intention of selling him, although in my view, he's probably the most saleable asset in terms of other clubs looking at it and thinking, He's proven himself in the Premier League. He's adaptable across the front line. He's still only 24. I think he is someone who has a very high value, but Newcastle very much want to build a side around him going forward. They don't want to lose him because they took a gamble bringing him in for £60 million at the time. And because other clubs had looked at him and hadn't spent that sort of money, didn't think it was worth the risk at that stage. Newcastle took that risk and it's paid off, but there's no guarantee that another deal of that capacity would pay off in the same way. So they don't want to lose him. The same applies to Bruno Guimaraes. The slight, subtle difference there is that there is maybe more of an acceptance that potentially Bruno Guimaraes, at 2 years older, if someone like Paris Saint-Germain does come in for him and make a huge offer, certainly if Newcastle don't get into Europe, they've still got a very good chance of doing that at this stage, but if they don't get into Europe, there is a more of a begrudging acceptance that maybe he could go. Not that he will go. I realise I wrote this the other day and people got very irate and said that I said he was going to go. That wasn't what I said, but I think there's more of an
records, right?
Yes, I think there's more of an acceptance though that it's not beyond the realms of possibility, and that it wouldn't come as a surprise necessarily, even if people at the very top of the club are going to do all they can to try and keep him. If that is the case, then Newcastle are going to have to try and find revenue elsewhere, and as I'm sure we'll come on to, I'm not sure there is that much revenue, certainly from the players who people would potentially be willing to let go.
Chris, just on kind of the January transfer window, and obviously there were lots of rumours about Miggy, about Kieran Trippier and Callum Wilson. Is that a massive coincidence going into this window? Because, I mean, I think if I was, and you know, I'm not a director at the club, obviously, but like, you know, I think if I was choosing a level of player to sell to then be able to build further, it would probably be someone of that kind of level rather than, as you say, one of the big hitters, as we've kind of talked about.
Yeah, I don't think there wasn't a surprise. Certainly not from a Callum Wilson point of view, because Newcastle need a striker this summer. There's absolutely no doubt about that. And given Wilson's age, given that he's going into the final year of his contract, it sort of feels like that may be a natural junction for him to move. And I think that although Newcastle didn't want to lose him mid-season, subsequently being injured, obviously, but they didn't want to lose him mid-season. Eddie Howe didn't want to countenance lose him at that point. People in and around Callum Wilson will understand to be thinking about his own future and, right, is it time to actually try and get him out of the club then? If he's going to be moved on this summer, is there a more attractive option in January? Kieran Trippier will be an interesting summer to see exactly what happens with him. I think from an ideal point of view, Newcastle would like to keep him. But again, when you look at age, when you look at length of his contract remaining, and for Kieran Trippier himself, maybe he thinks that if he can get one last payday, for want of a better term, that he may go. But I think for Miguel Almirón was almost the when we try to weigh up when Newcastle were trying to weigh up who should we sell and who can we sort of replace, but not in an ideal world. I mean, if you gave them an ideal blank slate, I'm sure they would keep Miguel Almirón as a squad player who can cover across the front three, would provide excellent backup from off the bench, and as you actually saw when he had competition last season, can actually step up to that next level. He hasn't had that competition this season, but I think it was trying to work out who actually had value but they could countenance letting go. And I think that's why Miguel Almirón came out as the one who they tried to move on. But for that very reason, it wasn't that they definitely wanted rid of him. It was just that he sort of fits in that balance, because you then go throughout the rest of the squad, and this is not to denigrate the rest of the squad, but if you go, how much are you going to realistically get for Jacob Murphy? Is it going to be worth selling Jacob Murphy for what you can get in terms of a PSR boost for what it brings in? Again, this is getting very complicated in terms of amortization, how much someone's worth. But it's also, let's just come down to the fee. You're not going to get a huge fee for Jacob Murphy. You're not going to get fees for Matt Ritchie, for Paul Dummett and others. So people can talk about moving them on, and that would help wages-wise. But actually, if you want to bring money in, you're going to have to sell someone who you probably in an ideal world wouldn't have done in that position. And that's why Almirón in January was the one who you looked at that stage. Again, this summer, that might again be the similar situation, but there are another couple of players who maybe come into that bracket as well. If you sell one of your academy graduates, then it goes down as pure profit, which is a ridiculous sort of scenario, really, because it almost encourages you to sell your own players. But basically, what that means is all of the money you sell them for, because you haven't paid for them initially, there is no book value, that you just gain all of that in pure profit. So someone like Sean Longstaff or the like, that's not beyond the realms of possibility if you really look at it in that stage. I'm not saying that's going to sell any of these players specifically, but these are all the conversations Newcastle are having to have. And because of the situation they now have with the defence, and the two very serious knee injuries they've suffered to Sven Botman and Jamal Lascelles, that has only complicated further what was already a very, very complicated window, because Newcastle were looking to sign a centre-back anyway. But now, how many players can they actually sustain in defence? And by that, I mean, how many do you actually need to make sure they're fit? Because Newcastle have said 6 to 9 months for them, but realistically, most ACL injuries are 9 months plus for someone to come back fully fit. So you're talking the end of the year. So that's basically the first half of next season. So you're going to need... you're going to need defenders for the first half of next season. But at the same time, you are also paying the wages for Jamal Lascelles and Sven Botman. In a PSR world, how do you sustain that? So this is a very, very complicated summer that Newcastle have that, unfortunately, over the course of the last fortnight, has only become even more complicated.
We'll be back for part three after these messages. Can I ask you a question on wages? And you might not know the answer, and this I might have the wrong information, but I was reading recently that some of the massive numbers that you see aren't necessarily the base wage that they're getting, that they are comprised of appearance fees and things like that. Is there any wiggle room there? Is there any scope that, like, Jamal Lascelles or Sven Botman's wages have been significantly decreased by the ACL injury, or am I really, really clutching at straws here?
No, well, some players, their wages are largely determined by appearances or the like, and Joe Linton is one of them, and I think that that came out when in his court case for when he was done for drink driving. That came out that he wasn't actually on the base level that people necessarily thought he was. So yeah. Some players, yes, you will gain a little bit by that, but it's not a big thing. But I do think wages aren't spoken enough about PSR. People always talk about transfer fees, but if you look at Leicester and the situation Leicester have got themselves into, they've been charged. The situation there is largely come about by wages. Wages are the constant that you have every single year. If you give someone a 5 or 6 year contract, as you just look at this Jeff Hendrick situation, Newcastle are still paying Jeff Hendrick, and that really still contributes to the PSR. Well, exactly. Yeah, but that is. I mean, he eventually comes off the books this summer, but that contributes to the PSR situation. Isaac Hayden still has another year or two left on his contract. It's the sort of unseen thing that people don't talk about, but actually, that's the big one. And Newcastle, part of the reason why Newcastle maybe can't compete for the very, very, very top level of player. Speaking to someone involved in recruitment, they were saying that at Newcastle, they want to go for the same players as Man City, Liverpool, Arsenal, but they then get there. And A, they're probably in a PSR world, they probably can't spend the same transfer fee. But also wages wise, they are not competing in the same territory. So then they go for the level of player below, which they may, in terms of what is actually proven from that player, what they have actually done, be paying slightly over the odds. But equally, they have to take a bit more of a risk on them than those clubs at the very top do, because they can't afford to compete for those proven players in every single capacity. And that's why Newcastle's wage structure is still massively below all of those biggest clubs. I mean, you look at Arsenal, for example, and Newcastle are being heavily linked with Aaron Ramsdale, and they do like him. He's someone, obviously, Eddie Howe knows very well from his Bournemouth days, but his wages would put him among the very, very top earners at Newcastle United if he came in. And he's a reserve goalkeeper at Arsenal at the moment. That's the difference, and that's the constant that carries every year. But Newcastle have been keen to keep their wage structure within line for what they can for now, largely for PSR reasons. Now, Joe Linton giving him a big new contract, that will affect those terms as well. And maybe when you look at the likes of Jeff Hendrick coming off the wage bill this summer, maybe part of the wages that were then earmarked to go on new signings this summer, maybe more of a proportion of that than ideally would have been liked, are going to be going towards Joe Linton now. And that adds into the melting pot of the difficulty of Newcastle and getting the balance of the figures right for this summer as well.
Yeah, super interesting. I think wages are really interesting in the way that it's all structured and all of that stuff, but we don't have to go into what I find interesting. I'm terribly, terribly boring. I think it would be remiss of us not to also talk about, and John kind of touched on the Brighton model, which was, buying these young players, sending them off to Europe to get game time and get experience, and then with the hope of obviously some of our academy, but buying in these young players in particular, and one sticks out, and we will be doing a full patron podcast on him next week when we have a lull in games, and we really want to do some deep diving into Yankuba Minte, who is just doing so well at Feyenoord, and a lot of people are saying online, like, oh, I can't wait for this kid to come back in the summer and slot straight in at right wing. Like, that's exactly what's going to happen. I'm a little bit more skeptical about it than that. Personally, I think that the league he's in is the Dutch league is a very different league to the Premier League. Obviously, he's doing really well and he's clearly got an amazing talent. Some of the goals that he's scoring and assists that he's providing are really beautiful to watch. If you want to go to YouTube and watch them, please do. But was he bought, like, do you know, Chris, any inside intel or just any kind of feeling? Was he bought as let's get him some game time and then slot him into the team, or was he bought as a let's increase his value and then sell him? Because I have a cynical view that it's the latter.
I don't think the two are necessarily mutually exclusive in the sense that I think it was an either or. I think it's my colleague actually Jacob Whitehead's just been across in the Netherlands and watched Minter. He was there for Minter scoring twice and assisting in the 6-0 victory over Ajax at the weekend. And so he's spoken to a lot of people about Minter, and there is a lot of excitement around him. Now, he wasn't an Eddie Howe signing per se, just like Garang Kuol wasn't an Eddie Howe signing per se. They were very much sort of Dan Ashworth, Steve Nixon led in terms of players who Newcastle have looked at and tried to identify in the way that Chelsea do, in the way that Manchester City do, that basically all of the big clubs do, and Brighton do to a certain extent as well, as John's made the point on, that you sign these players and then you send them out on loan and see how they do develop. And then either they become part of your own first team because you haven't spent the same sort of fee that you would have to if they were established in Europe or in the Premier League, certainly. Or if not, then hopefully they improve to at least a degree that you do get some PSR money back. Now, the thing with Yankuba Minder is that Newcastle paid quite a lot of money for him. It was about 8 or 9 million. So they would need a good fee for him. Now, they probably could get that this summer if they wanted him. But at the moment, my understanding is that all possibilities remain open when it comes to Minter. And Eddie Howe wants to actually take a look at him in pre-season, that he wasn't the player he necessarily signed. But equally, if he's got so much other business to do this summer, if Minter can come in, certainly if Newcastle, say, are in the Europa Conference League next season, if you could play Minter on a Thursday night there and it's someone who can rotate your squad and hopefully get him greater game time then see how he does, that could be an option. So Eddie Howe wants to look at it and see whether he can work and whether he is far enough in his development for that. The most likely option still at this stage, I think, is that he would go out on loan again, potentially back to Feyenoord, but potentially somewhere elsewhere if Newcastle want to challenge him and see if he can deal in a different league. But then the third option is that if a club comes in with an enticing offer and Newcastle actually need the money PSR-wise, they wouldn't be completely against necessarily moving on Yankuba Minder. Now, that's not me saying they are going to sell him. I'm just saying that I think you could look at just about any player who Newcastle is in and around the fringes at Newcastle at the moment. And there are decisions to be made on them. And it very much depends on what market is out there and what offers they get. And also what other business they can conduct. If they end up signing a right winger and a forward in the summer and Minder isn't going to get any sort of game time, then both the loan option out and the PSR option in terms of selling him increase. But if Newcastle can't get a right winger, then if you already have Minter and he comes into pre-season, you think, actually, he's not too far off. He could probably play in the Europa Conference League, then we see later in the season. Then he becomes an option there. So I realise that's me sitting on the fence, but there isn't actually a decision. My understanding is there isn't a decision actually made there yet and that all possibilities remain open. And it isn't beyond the realms of possibility that Yankuba Minter could be in a Newcastle shirt in sort of Thursday night European competition next season.
I mean, my feeling from a fan's perspective, at least the impression I get, is you look at our forward line and what's the weakest part of it. It's probably the right wing, to be kind as I can to Miggy Almiron and Jacob Murphy. And so then, you know, when you're, you know, scrolling through YouTube on a weekend or Twitter even, and you see Minter's goals and his assists and kind of how dominant he looks in a very different league, then, you know, of course fans are going to look at it and go, well, this makes perfect sense. You just bring him in and it just works. But Chris, I think, you know, you're spot on. You know, they're going to bring him in, they're going to have a look at what he looks like pre-season and they'll make an assessment on it. I would be very surprised if we went out and signed a right winger without certainly having a look at Minter and seeing whereabouts he is in his development. And, you know, who knows, it's nice to get excited about players that might play for you. So I don't want to sell him off just yet. But I think the other thing is you don't want it to be another one of those players that we sell on and then looks like, you know, like, and I know it's a bit of a different example, but the likes of someone like Florian Thauvin, who signed, you know, didn't do amazing in 6 months. We loaned him out to France, and then he, you know, within a year or two, he looked like this incredible player. So, and with coaching from Eddie Howe, the potential for Minter isn't necessarily where he is now, is it? It's what could happen from there. So it is, yeah, a really intriguing one overall, mostly because of the success he's had in the Eredivisie.
I mean, you talk about the right wing position and whether Newcastle signed someone there. I mean, this is going to sound like a negative point, and I suppose to a degree it is. But I mean, going into the summer, realistically, Newcastle are not going to solve every single problem that they have within their squad. It's not. Eddie Howe said the other week that it would basically be impossible in a PSR world to do a full squad overhaul. Now, I think he was trying to dampen expectations to a degree there, because Newcastle intend to do significant business, and I'm sure there will be significant ins and outs. But it isn't going to be that every single player who, I suppose, a significant proportion of Newcastle fans may think is not quite at the level required to get Newcastle to take the next step is going to be moved on, and that suddenly every single position is going to be bolstered to the degree that everyone would like, because that Newcastle don't have the capacity to do that. It's going to be, as I said, it was already a complicated window. The defensive situation makes it more difficult. And if you just think about whatever the budget may be, say if it is, and this is just me plucking figures out of thin air, but say if it is somewhere between sort of 100 and 150 million, if you want to sign a good striker, you're talking at least a quarter, but probably a third, if not more, of that budget is already going to go on that one position. So then you've got to work out what you can do with everything else. And so it is going to be a difficult summer. There are going to be some, I believe that Newcastle will make some exciting signings, but it isn't going to be that going into next season, you're going to look at every single position and think, yeah, that's the squad totally sorted now.
Well, fingers crossed they change all the rules in June and we can really take advantage of that and go on a crazy spending spree. That's what I'd like to see happen. We have to end it there, unfortunately. Thank you so much to Chris. I feel like we could actually chat about it and particularly the summer and particularly our players for hours more, but we have to let Chris have a life and John, of course. I don't have one of those. Thank you so much, Chris, for joining us. Thank you, John, for joining us. Thank you, everybody, for watching, listening. Once more, with feeling, we are on Patreon. It's between £3 and £8 a month. We'd love you to join us there. We have so much additional content, including something on Minter coming next week. So please do have a look and join us there. Take care. Good night.
This podcast is brought to you by Aspers Casino Newcastle, home of the Mags £4 pint, available on all draft beers for all NUFC home and televised games, 12 p.m. to 12 a.m. Over 18s only, visit begamblerware.org, be drinkaware. For details and T's and C's, visit aspersnewcastle.co.uk.